Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just spoke with Chi Liang He about his new book, Gilded Voices, Economics, Politics, and Storytelling in the Yangtze Delta since 1949, and that came out with Brill Publishers just this year in 2012. Now, this is a really interesting book, and the stories that Chi Liang tells about how he came to this project and the interviews especially that brought him to this book are equally fascinating. And so I'm going to keep this intro short and let you get right to the main event. But I will say that this is a book that's really interesting, not only for what it's arguing about the connection between politics and the market in how we understand cultural history of modern China, but also in its emphasis on the importance of taking genre and literary form seriously when we are evaluating the historical power and impact and significance of documents. And so I had a great time talking with him, and I hope you'll enjoy. We're here today at New Books in East Asian Studies to talk with Chi Liang He about his recent book, Gilded Voices, Economics, Politics, and Storytelling in the Yangtze Delta since 1949. Now, one of the really interesting things about this book, and one of the reasons that I was really excited to read it as a historian of China, is that it's not just of interest to scholars of literary and performance studies, scholars of theater, but also gives historians. And historians, I think, of all periods of Chinese history and beyond, actually, a window into a really interesting form of performed history or performed historiography in modern China. So welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Chi Liang, and thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, so, it's my pleasure.
So could you start us off by saying a little bit about what brought you to this field? What brought you to this particular field of Chinese history and also to this particular topic within that broader field?
Okay, very good. Actually, this is not a traditional first book for a young scholar. This is not based on my dissertation, but it was derived from my dissertational research. It was like 4 years ago, I should say 5 years ago. It was in the summer of 2007. I went to Shanghai to conduct the research to expand my dissertation about a famous elopement happening in 1929. I interviewed a Pingtan artist who continued to tell the story about the elopement from 50s all the way to the 2000s. He talked about not just how he performed the story, but also a lot of other things about the Pingtan storytellers, the communist officials, the censorship, and other things. So I was very interested in this, and I think it should be my second project after I revised my dissertation to be my first book. But things changed dramatically. Eventually, I had chances to interview other Pingtan storytellers, and I figured that the whole generation was getting old. A lot of people I mentioned in my book, as you can see, actually passed away in the time span of 5 years between 2007 and now, when I was working on the book. So I think it was a pressing task for me to finish the book as soon as possible. So this was the major reason why I started to work on the book in 2008 and 2009, and a few years later, the book was published. So I think it started as just a byproduct of my dissertation, but it ended up to be my first book. And I think another factor behind my working on this book was about the conflicts of the artists and the state throughout the 60 years in the People's Republic of China. I think the theme was extremely interesting because I always assumed previously that the state always dominated the society, the artists, and the audience all along. But as I interviewed all those artists, and their listeners, their fans, I figured that actually they had the audience, the artists, the performers had a lot initiatives, and they challenged the authorities of the political authorities. So this was the major reason I think I had something very different to say. So I think my book would become the first one to examine the market's role in mediating between the state and the artists in People's Republic of China, especially before the 1970s. So this was the reason why I started the book as my first project instead of my dissertation. Thank you.
That's fascinating. And that's actually really interesting to hear about it. If you don't mind my asking, what was the topic of your dissertation and what part of that actually led you to this interview in the first place?
Okay. My dissertation was about two sensational cases in Shanghai in the 1920s. The first one was a murder of a prostitute in 1920, and the second one was a sensational elopement between a young lady from a wealthy family and her male servant in the late 1920s. Storytellers started to tell the story of the elopement as early as in the 1930s. In the 50s, as well as in the 1980s, 90s, and the 2000s, continued to perform the story on stage. Initially, I tried to revise the second half of my dissertation to be a book. I would like to examine how the same story was represented in different ways in different periods of time in modern China, to examine the urban culture and how urban culture made an impact on policy making and consumers' personal identities. So this was the project I had in my mind before I came back to Shanghai to conduct the interviews with the artists.
Ah, great. And then actually, it sounds like that story of the elopement is the basis for one of the Pingtan stories that you talk about in chapter 6 of this book, I think.
Exactly. Great. Yeah.
Okay, so wonderful. This is all really interesting to hear about. So why don't we actually get right into the book? First things first, for our listeners, who, especially those of whom who may never have heard of Pingtan storytelling, let's start at the very beginning. So this is a book about Pingtan storytelling. Can you explain for our listeners what Pingtan storytelling is? What is that and how would you define it?
Okay, yeah, Pingtan storytelling it was originated in the Yangtze Delta, to be more specific. It was created in Suzhou, a prosperous city ever since the imperial times in China. The storytellers used the Suzhou dialect to tell the stories about the wars, the politics, the romantic loves between scholars and the beauties, and many other things. And in People's Republic of China, the storytellers were required to tell the stories about the Chinese Revolution and the Communist Party, as we can all expect. The Pingtan storytelling was actually a genre of two subgenres. The first one was called the Tanzi. Actually, there are a lot of scholars in North America who are specialized in studying Tanzi in imperial times and in modern times. Tanzi were basically a storytelling art with musical accompaniment. And there was another subgenre, which was Pinghua. Pinghua was a musicless subgenre of Pingtan. Well, in Pinghua performances, the storytellers just told the stories without any music. So, and usually Tan's stories were about romantic loves, and the Pinghua stories were about the wars, coup d'etats, and knight errants, martial arts, or something like this. So Tan's was a more masculine genre, subgenre, and Pinghua was a more masculine subgenre.
Great. So the book uses this example of Ping Tan storytelling to re-examine cultural reform in the People's Republic of China. And in doing so, you, I think, very effectively challenge some widely held assumptions about that history in several ways. Now, one of the major assumptions I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about, and this comes up right at the beginning of the book. Ultimately, the book argues that the role of the party or state has been overemphasized in this history, while that of the market has been largely overlooked in scholarship about this phenomenon, or scholarship rather on cultural reform, especially before the Cultural Revolution. So can you talk about this, this way that you're trying to change scholarship on cultural reform by emphasizing or at least recovering a space for the role of the market?
Okay, good question. For a long time, we have the assumption that the Chinese Communist Party was very good at disciplining the whole society, including the artists and their consumers. And we also had the assumption that the Communist Party and the Communist regime were specialized in collectivizing the artists. As a result, all the artists, including the performers, became propagandists in a sense. They were required, they were forced to propagate the agenda, social and political agendas of the Communist China. So this was the impression we have after reading a lot of scholarly works we have nowadays in North America, in China, and in many other places in the world. After I interviewed the artists, especially the Pingtan artists in China, I got a different conclusion that actually the state was not that omnipotent and omnipresent. There were a lot of holes in the system. A large number of, especially Pingtan artists, relied on the market to survive and thrive. The government was not able to patronize all the Pingtan artists because of the lack of financial capability. The government might issue a lot of documents to urge all the local governments to collectivize those artists, but in reality, it was unrealistic. It was economically unrealistic. As a result, the artists, most of the Pingtan artists, self-employed in the most part of the People's Republic of China. They were self-employed artists in the 50s, and they were self-employed artists in the 80s, 90s, and at the present. So very clearly, there was a gap between the political pronouncement and the reality in China. So this was the reason I would challenge some long-held with assumptions about the cultural reform in China. We always pay a lot of attention to what the political documents had to say, but we usually ignore what the real issue was in the Chinese society, and the Pingtan storytelling gave us the window through which we can better understand the Chinese society, politics, and the market. So this was my intention when writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And in fact, that was one of the really interesting and really surprising things in the book for me, is how important you're arguing that market forces were. And I think it's a very refreshing perspective to bring to this kind of a case study. Now, another thing that the book tries to do, and you're very explicit about this in the introduction, is to argue for a kind of continuity in the way we understand this period, and specifically for continuity between the Maoist and post-Maoist periods. You argue here that the Cultural Revolution was actually not a watershed in the history of Bintan storytelling. So can you talk about, just briefly, the importance of this kind of recourse to continuity and this argument about continuity for you?
Okay, good question. Some scholars have discussed the continuity between the Republican China and the People's Republic of China. Basically, a lot of those scholars don't believe that 1949 was not a watershed in the Chinese history. There were a lot of continuities. In a similar fashion, I would argue that late 1970s was not a watershed either. In terms of the cultural reform and the cultural management, we can see the continuities between Maoist China and the post-Maoist China. Let me give you an example. Throughout the People's Republic of China, culture was always a second-tier thing. Economic development in different forms has always been the key issue for the government. So in both periods of time, Maoist and the post-Maoist China, the government tried to apply the ways, the rules they got from economic development or economic reform to the cultural realm. So, for example, I have pointed in the third chapter, the government tried to use the way of planned economy to the development of Bintan culture in the 50s and the 60s. In a similar vein, in the 80s, the government once again tried to borrow the ways of contract system. In Chinese, it was 承包制, to revitalize the Bintan troops and artists. So in both cases, I would argue that the government always believed that the culture was just the afterthought behind the economic development. So in this sense, I would say they shared certain measures and approaches to deal with the cultural development and the reforms in China. So this was the reason I would argue that post-Maoist China and Maoist China had a lot of similarities. Interestingly enough, my book actually didn't cover the Cultural Revolution because it is my belief that Cultural Revolution was an exception in the Chinese history in the past 60 years. It only during the Cultural Revolution that the government really dominate the society and the culture in China. And another aspect about the continuity between Maoist and post-Maoist China was about the flexible approaches and the policies adopted by the political authorities. In both times, the political authorities always took artists' livelihood into consideration when they tried to push for some radical cultural reforms or changes in China. So in both cases, the artists' livelihood would become a barrier of cultural radicalism in in the Communist Party. So I would say this was the reason I argue that we needed to pay some attention to the continuities between Maoist and the post-Maoist China.
Thank you so much. Now, you've already, in the introduction, you mentioned a wide range of kinds of sources that you brought to this project. You've already talked a little bit about some of them and mentioning, in particular, the importance of interviews. Now, you've already talked about the ways that that shaped the direction that your story took in ways I think that are very, very fascinating. Along those lines, sort of staying with the topic of interviews, were there any major surprises in the course of these interviews for you? Because I know that it was a major part of this project. You talk about them a lot in the book. It clearly shaped the direction that the book took. So any major surprises, or were there any interviews individually that particularly stood out for you in the course of your research?
Actually, the very first interview was already a surprise to me. The artist who told the story about the elopement in late 1920s cried. I was very surprised. I didn't expect such emotions in an interview like this. He told me that he suffered a lot in the 80s when he tried to gain profits from telling the story. In the beginning, before I went to his home, I had the assumption that the Chinese government in the 80s and the 90s must support the artists to tell or perform this kind of stories, because it had a lot to do with the nostalgia for old Shanghai, the capitalism and the globalism in Shanghai in the 20s and the 30s. But I was totally unexpected that he actually had a lot of troubles in staging the story. He told me that his story was banned in Shanghai. The Shanghai bureaucrats consistently harassed him when he performed the story in like Jiangsu and Zhejiang, the other parts of Yangtze Delta. So this was the major reason I eventually decided to write a book like this. I think it was interesting. It was a sad story, and it was interesting to explore the life and the careers of the storytellers. There were some other surprising things in my interviews, of course. For example, a storyteller who was purged in the late 50s refused to receive my interview. He was purged in the late 50s because of the incident I mentioned in a chapter of my book. He was sent to the remote western province of Qinghai, actually. He stayed there for almost 20 years. Yeah. So he must have a very good story to tell about the conflicts and the revival of his career in late 70s. He was a very successful storyteller, a very successful self-employed storyteller throughout the history of People's Republic of China, but he just refused to say anything to me. And one more thing, a lot of storytellers who did conduct interviews with me actually might not tell the truth. I'm not suggesting that they were lying in the interviews, but they could find a better way to hide their intentions. So I needed to be very careful when I analyzed their remarks after I started to work on these interview scripts. So this was another thing I would like to mention.
That's so interesting. there are now like a million things that I want to ask you about these
Okay.
Things, but I won't do that because I'll move on because there's so many other things that I want to ask you about the book. So one of the other kinds of sources, though, that I think I want to ask you about before we move into the chapters is something that you mentioned being very important and very powerful at the beginning. And this was the importance of archival sources. Now, you mentioned that some of the archival materials that you quoted in the book, in addition to being really central for how you understand the story, are no longer publicly available. So can you talk for our listeners about the archives you use and the ways that they shaped your project?
Oh, good. Archives are particularly important to my project because only with the assistance of the archives, I can give a big and a complete picture about the lives and the careers of those artists and the world of Bintan art as a whole. According to the rule of Shanghai Municipal Archive, the documents, the files of 30 years of age would be open to the government, to the public, I should say. So that means I can review the archives in 1982 and before. Of course, those sensitive documents have all been hidden by the Shanghai Municipal Archives. Those produced during the anti-rightist movement in 1957, and those produced during the Cultural Revolution between 1966 and 1976 were basically gone. So I cannot do any research about these things. So it was a pity. I was infuriated when I searched for those archives. And this was another reason why I couldn't really write a chapter about the Cultural Revolution. Another thing was about the missing of some opened archives. I used to see a couple of documents about the young Bintan artists' protest in the 1960s. They tried to withdraw from the state-owned troops, and they tried to establish their own Bintan performing enterprises. This was a very interesting story. It basically, this kind of information gives me the idea that in the 1960s, there were some resistance and the protests in Shanghai, but not just Shanghai, but in many parts of China. But because this specific artist has become very famous nowadays, I don't know for what reason and in what way she was able to ask the Shanghai Municipal Archive to withdraw this file from the whole package. So after a couple of years, I was able to find the document, I think, in 2007, but in 2010, I was no longer able to read it. So this was another thing I found very interesting about the archives. One more thing was about the instructions written by some bureaucrats of Communist Party. And some instructions were written in a haphazard way. I don't think the persons who made the instructions actually thought very carefully. They just write down what were in their mind. So these information were very important because it shows that they were thinking something else. And as I have said in the book, actually, when reading the archives, we can understand what the Communist Party officials initially thought about certain issues, and then they changed their mind. So the process of decision making was very illuminating to my book. And in other cases, some texts were deleted from the archives, but we can still read them. So I think if I work even harder, I may even get some more interesting and inspiring conclusions by reading the between the lines. See that this is the thought I have regarding the archives.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move into the next chapter of the book.
Okay.
The first chapter introduces readers many aspects of Pingtan storytelling, including the organization of the stories, the modes of performance, the types of spaces that the performances took place in, the types of skills employed, etc., etc. You introduce here some of the most important elements of a Pingtan performance, and that includes, or those elements include humor. They include something called stuck ins or chua-chua.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, yes, which is really interesting and becomes important later on to the story. They include elaboration episodes and flexibility. Now, this actually brings us to a really interesting conceptual point that you make. So one of the things that you do in the book is that you're re-examining the assumption about the effectiveness of the Communist Party's censorship efforts in this period, right?
And
in fact, the history of censorship in the context of Pingtan actually plays a major role in many of the chapters of the books. So in this first chapter, you're arguing that the very structure and the very nature, the very form of Pingtan as a mode of performance actually helps make it censorship unfriendly. So you're actually arguing that one of the things that impacts this history of censorship, or the kind of failure thereof in certain respects, interestingly, is the form itself of the genre. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Actually, I have a strong belief that the form of a specific genre matters. So when we talk about a specific cultural form, such as the film, the drama, or whatever, the novel, we need to understand what's the uniqueness of the specific form. So I'm studying Pingtan storytelling. I'm not studying, say, Beijing opera or a Chinese novel or Chinese painting. So I need to ask myself, what was unique to the Pingtan storytelling? And eventually I concluded that Pingtan was, first of all, a highly individualistic art. The Pingtan storytellers were able to garner high profits with two or three, even one storytellers. So they had the tendency to resisted to the collectivization effort by the state after 1949. Another thing about the Pingtan storytelling was the flexibility in performance. So in most of the cases, the audience would expect that the storytellers could tell something outside the story, because the storytellers as well as the listeners were actually very familiar with the stories, especially those classic stories. So they needed to get something new on a daily basis. So this was required by the market. So for generations of storytellers, they learned how to perform in a very flexible way on stage. So if that was the case, I would argue that the censors would have no chance to listen to the real storytelling on the stage, because as soon as the censors came, the storytellers would automatically change their contents and the form. So this what makes this Pingtan storytelling censorship unfriendly. And the Pingtan storytelling had many interesting aspects, such as the organization, So Pindar storytelling would become a very useful case for me to battle the assumptions about the Communist Party's ability to collectivize the artists, because most of the Pindar storytellers remained self-employed exactly because of the characteristics of Pindar organization. So this was the reason I explained some characteristics of Pindar storytelling in the very first chapter. But I was not just talking about what Pindar was in the first chapter. I talked about Pindar's organizations, Pindar's modes of performance, Pindar's training and lack of texts, because all these things had strong political implications, and they would contribute to Pindar artists resist to the state's supervision and intervention in the past 60 years. So this was the reason I detailed the Pindar in the first chapter.
Thank you so much. Now, we talked a little bit about state censorship, and the next chapter mm-hmm. actually gets us sort of complicates this story by raising the issue of what might be called self-censorship. So this
yes.
chapter... Okay, so in the context of this chapter, it's now the early 1950s, and communist cadres are pushing for a sweeping reform of Pindar storytelling in order to fit the broader CCP agenda. Now, this chapter explores one result of this, which is called, or which you translate as cutting the tail, a movement by Pindar performers that has been described as a kind of self-censorship. Can you describe that for our, talk about that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, the first chapter was set in the 3 years immediately after the CCP takeover of China. So this was a crucial time for all Pindar storytellers because they needed to make a decision about how to deal with the new historical times. Some of them would be willingly to join the performing enterprises organized by the CCP, and some of them would choose to be the self-employed storytellers just like before. But one thing was very confusing in the first several years of the People's Republic of China was to what extent the new regime would tolerate the classic stories. According to a lot of radical leftists in CCP, the classic stories were filled with feudal ideologies such as polygamy, such as the loyalty to the emperors. So everyone was confused, not just the storytellers, but also the government bureaucrats, the CCP officials. So in these confusing times, storytellers tried to survive the regime change by censoring themselves. They cut the tail of feudalism. So I translate it as cutting the tail. Actually, this was Zhang Weibo in Chinese. But it didn't work, to be honest. What I tried to point out in the first chapter was, first of all, even though until today a lot of Pindar historians in China continue to boast that the cutting the tail movement was very successful because virtually all the Pindar storytellers quit their classic stories and started to tell the new stories, but this was not true, as I have said in the book. Actually, a lot of storytellers secretly or openly resisted to the movement of cutting the tail, they continued to tell the classic stories. Some of them initially agreed to quit to the classic stories, but eventually they resumed telling the classic stories. So my point was, the movement of cutting the tail never really prevailed in China, in Yangtze Delta, because there were still a lot of storytellers who continued to tell the classic stories. And the second, the movement of cutting the tail was actually supported by the government. And the governmental coercion was very, very clear in the process. The cadres actually secretly punished the artists who continued to tell the stories, the classic stories. And the cadres sometimes criticized the journals, the magazines who didn't approve of the staging of the news stories. And the third, the movement of cutting the tail ended in 1952. Actually, it gives us some idea about the market's role in the process. The artists simply couldn't survive by only telling the news stories. They had to make money by telling the classic stories. The audience just didn't buy. So from this, we can understand that the government, even though the government tried to push for a total reform, total change in Pingtan storytelling, that just didn't work out. The storytellers would starve if they continued to tell the new stories and quit the classic stories. So the government had to take the storytellers' livelihood into consideration this time. So this was the reason why the movement of cutting the tail ended very quickly after it was implemented in 1951, just 1 year, I would say. But at any rate, my point was this movement was never really completely carried out. It was initiated, yes, by some progressive storytellers, but in the end of the day, it was the storytellers who succeeded in resisting to the movement they initiated themselves. So from this, I can point out that the radical cultural movement in early People's Republic of China was not that successful as the historians in China choose to believe.
Great. Now, even given that, one of the really interesting things that you go on to show in the course of the book, and this is both in the next chapter and also throughout the other chapters, is that there were actually quite substantial or significant transformations or sort of evolutions of Pingtan as a genre over the course of this history. So very late in the book, in one of the last chapters, you mentioned, for example, the kind of transformations that emerge from the availability of Pingtan storytelling on television, and the fact that you actually were able to experience in your own research some of these stories through the internet. Now, one of the transformations early on in this genre is something that you describe in the next chapter here that comes directly from some of the implications of chapter two. And this is the development of a new genre of Pingtan stories that were called middle-length Pingtan stories. Now, because this seems so, the development of this new genre of Pingtan seems actually really important, not just for this chapter, but for actually setting the stage for what's going to happen later. Can you talk a little bit about this new genre? I think it's a 3-hour-long stories. And why is that important, and why was that so central to what happened in the story of Pingtan?
Yeah, middle-length pintan stories were extremely important, especially for the CCP officials, because initially it was created in order to promote the social and the political agendas of the Communist Party. But it turned out to be a major amusement for the city residents in Shanghai and in many other big cities in the Yangtze Delta. So the thrust of the argument in Chapter 3 was that the politicized culture sometimes would become entertainment. So I tried to invent a term, entertainizing politics, to indicating the process. This genre, the middle-length pintan story, was created in early 1950s. Initially, the storytellers cooperated with the government, tried to complete a story within 3 hours. So if that's the case, pintan storytelling would be very similar to drama and the films in terms of the length. And the storytellers didn't expect the success of the genre, because they still felt that the full-length stories would be the mainstream genre in pintan storytelling. But unexpectedly, listeners in the Yangtze Delta welcomed the middle-length stories because of the change of working rhythms in the cities. And because of the length, a lot of previously non-fans, such as students and workers, would become the pintan listeners, because previously they didn't have time to enjoy pintan on a daily basis. They could not afford to go to theaters or tea houses to listen to pintan storytellers every night. But when the middle-length pintan stories were performed, they would have the chance to go to theaters. I use the term story house, of course, in my book. Once a week, for example. So in this sense, the creation of a new genre rebuilt the pintan storytelling as a mass entertainment in Shanghai and in other big cities in the Yangtze Delta. So this was the major point I would like to make in my chapter. But another thing about the chapter was that even though the CCP officials tried to infuse revolutions and other ideologies into the stories, but the audience enjoyed the middle-length stories as entertainments, not as political indoctrination. So from this, I argue that even the political culture, even the propaganda would be taken as entertainment in the 1950s and the 60s. In essence, propaganda and entertainment shared something in common. That means both propaganda and entertainment should capture the audience. So this was the reason I would say middle-length pintan stories were extremely successful as a new subgenre of pintan storytelling, even though by nature it started as a political culture, but eventually the audience received the stories for different reasons and purposes, and they were taken as pure entertainment for a lot of listeners. On the other side of the story, I would argue that because of the creation of the middle-length Pintan stories, the government officials were very satisfied with the new creation because they could use this new genre to compete with self-employed storytellers in the market, which resulted in some conflicts, of course, we can see from the next chapter. So by studying the middle-length Pintan stories, the government, the cadres, the CCP officials were good at creating new markets to both garner profits and promote communist ideologies. So this is the dual roles of middle-length Pintan stories in the 50s and the 60s.
Great, thank you so much. Now, in the interest of time, what I'm going to do is I'll just sort of briefly mention some of the things that you do in some of the chapters along the way, and then sort of bring us to the last part of the book, which also is a very interesting continuation of this set of arguments that you're giving us that really, really seem to prioritize or ask us to prioritize the form of a genre, the form of either a literary or performative genre, in looking at the historical implications that emerge from that form. So in that, you've already mentioned this conflict in the next chapter arose between state-employed and self-employed Pingtan storytellers, and you describe the implications of this and the effect of this on the communities of Pingtan storytellers. Then you take us through the period after the Great Leap Forward, which was completely disastrous, as many listeners will know. But after, as the economy revived and cultural control sort of loosened, what that cultural thaw meant for Pingtan storytellers and the ways that affected the kinds of troops that grew up out of that and the kinds of people who were actually engaged in these performances and the sort of forms of resistance that they were able to enact using these new troops and this new sort of cultural thaw as a platform. You then move us into the reform era, right? Look at the new emerging market that arises, especially in the context of this formation of five collectively owned troops in Shanghai and the way that sort of what happens after they lose their professional status, and the Cultural Revolution basically deals a really crushing blow to this as a profession. And in that chapter, or in chapter six, listeners will remember that you mentioned actually early on what brought you into this book project in the first place, which was an interview with one of the authors about this Pingtan story about an elopement. Okay, so you mentioned two self-employed performers in this chapter, and then I'll sort of bring us into the later chapters after I ask you about this, but one of these performers that you mentioned, his name was Yang Zijiang.
Yes. Okay. Yangtze River, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, this storyteller is really, really interesting because, as you tell us, he was the first. This brings us into issues of intellectual property and authorship, because this is apparently the first Pingtan storyteller who actually used the legal system to defend intellectual property rights. So, because that's potentially of really wide interest to a lot of different kinds of people who might be interested in this book, can you talk about that a little bit for us?
Yeah, Yang Zijiang has always been a unique storyteller because, first of all, he didn't receive any training as a storyteller. He was from a wealthy family which had a lot of relationships with the Kuomintang nationalist bureaucrats before 1949. Because of this, he lost everything. His parents were arrested by the communist authorities after 1949. He lost his job, his properties, everything. So he had to embark on a storytelling career to survive in the 50s. He didn't receive the training, so So he couldn't sing, so he could only tell the Pinghua stories without music, without a musical accompaniment. But he was a very different person, essentially because he had received a high education. He was a university graduate in Shanghai in the 40s. So he had the ability to write the stories better than anybody else in the world of Pintan. Most of the Pintan stories, by the way, especially those in the older generations, were illiterate. They couldn't write by themselves. So Yang Zijiang could write. So in the 80s, he was banned from the world of Pintan for 10 years. In the time span of one decade, he developed four stories. Actually, he in his lifetime, he wrote many more than just four. One of the stories was very popular. It was about the Kangxi Emperor in the Qin Dynasty. This story was extremely popular, so that some Pintan storytellers, especially the young Pintan storytellers in the Suzhou Pintan troupe, came to learn the story from Yang Zijiang, and they earned the fame and the fortune because of the story. In the late 1990s, Yang Zijiang learned that these people, these artists, became nationwide popular Pintan storytellers. They earned their fames because of the story he wrote. So he was very angry about that. I don't know if they actually negotiated with each other in the 90s before Yang Zijiang brought the lawsuit on the court. And many storytellers in the late 1990s didn't believe that Yang Zijiang would win the lawsuit, to be honest, because Yang Zijiang was always punished by the political authorities in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, and the 80s. But at this time, China was entering into a new age. China was about to join the WTA. So intellectual properties became a very sensitive issue nationwide. And the court ruled that the Suzhou Pingtan troupe had to discuss with Yang Zijiang, negotiate with Yang Zijiang in order to work out a deal. Eventually, Yang Zijiang got some compensations from the Suzhou Pingtan troupe. I interviewed Yang Zijiang personally before he died. This was really a shock to me, actually. He was very proud that eventually he could win something from the state, according to himself. But this was a very unique thing in the world of Pingtan, because for hundreds of years, disciples learned stories from their masters. And before the masters adopted those disciples, the disciples' family would pay a sum of money, usually like 100 silver dollars or 200 silver dollars, something like this. So if the fees have been paid, that means the disciples would automatically get the rights to tell the stories developed their own masters. But in this case, Yang Zijiang actually challenged this century-long practice in the Pingtan storytelling. And the Suzhou Pingtan troupe was very unhappy with this, is exactly because of this reason. If this practice was vetoed by the legal authorities, it would be impossible for the masters to pass down their stories to their disciples in the future. So Yang Zijiang was sometimes regarded as a black sheep in the in the world of Pintan storytelling because of this. You can understand the most interesting part of the story was the new environment, new legal and economic environment in the late 1990s in China, which enabled Yang Zijiang to win the lawsuit against the Suzhou Pingtan troop. So that was the interesting part.
Thank you so much. Now, in order to, I don't want to keep you for too long. So before we wrap up, there's just one more thing that I'd like to ask you. And what I'll do is I'll mention for listeners, after this chapter, the final body chapter before the epilogue looks at the rise of Pingtan stories about the political histories of the PRC and the CCP since the late 1990s. And so this brings us into very kind of modern context. So one of the things that happens is that specifically we see a transformation in the spaces of Pingtan and sort of Pingtan story houses into public spaces for socialization of retirees and for the elderly. And so there's a really interesting component to this story, which is about the kind of history of social management of the elderly and retired, and which is really, really interesting and I think surprising in this chapter. But the thing that I want to ask you about very briefly before we wrap up is another element of the story that I think actually very interestingly bears on historiography, and it, very surprisingly. So you argue here that the stories of one of the artists, Li Gang, okay, like mm-hmm. the stories of Yang Zijiang, who you just were talking about, they actually counteracted state efforts to, as you say, obliterate, right, unapproved memories. So unapproved memories of the kind of nasty bits of PRC history from listeners' lived experience. And so you're arguing here that these performances actually functioned as a form of history making for the audiences. They functioned as a form of collective memory. And this is actually really interesting from the perspective of just the way we think about the formation of historical records. And so I'd love, before we wrap up here, if you could say a little bit about that and that aspect of what's happening here.
Yeah, the last part of the book was about the reconstruction of history of People's Republic of China and the CCP in the stories. So I was basically talking about two things. First, it was about the aging society in China, and the government faced a real challenge about how to deal with the aging society in China, how to manage, how to pacify these retirees. The second one was about how these retirees received the Pingtan stories in their day-to-day life. I think Pingtan was important for the retirees in the Yangtze Delta essentially because it gives them the chance to go to a story house on a daily basis, so they could stay with the same group of listeners every day. So as a kind of public group came into being because of this. When they were in the story houses, they enjoyed the so-called political stories, the stories about the PRC and the CCP's history. And in the meantime, I argue that in the past 60 years, a lot of historical events were erased from the Chinese historiography. The government sponsored historians were reluctant to talk about things like a cultural revolution as well as the Tiananmen massacre. But interestingly enough, all these events found mention in the stories by Li Gang, Yang Zijiang, and many other storytellers. So these storytellers helped these elder storytellers to reconstruct their memories, to remind what was going on when they were young. And these retirees, these older listeners, had been Red Guards or the people who were purged by the Communist Party or as the sent-down youth. So the storytellers played a very significant role to help them refresh their memories. But in the meantime, the storyteller reminded that they were not the only the victims or the actors of the past. They were just the good people who lived through the past. They were just like the commoners in the classic stories who survived the wars, the natural disasters, the good deeds among the emperors and the bureaucrats in classic stories. So in this sense, the political Pintan stories played a very important role to assure these older listeners of personal identities as a people who lived through the past six decades. So this was the point I would like to make.
Thank you so much. Now, Qiliang, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much for being with us today. Now, there's a lot in the book it's a very rich book, and there's a lot that we didn't have a chance to talk about in our hour today. Is there anything in particular that we didn't cover but that you'd like to point out for our listeners, especially those who may not yet have had the chance to read the book?
One thing I would like to point out is that I always think genre matters. This was the reason why I put the chapter one to function as a introductory of the introductory chapter of Pintan storytelling. I think Pintan storytellers were particularly good at resisting the state intervention and supervision because of the genre. They were trained to be elusive sometimes. So this was the reason why extremely interesting and illuminating to study the Pintan storytelling and its relationship with the politics and the market. Another thing is that I may want to write another book about Pintan storytelling during the Cultural Revolution, but it's going to be hard. But I think it's good. It's going to be a good complement to this one.
Wonderful. And so now that this book is out, what's next for you? What can we look forward to reading next, or at least what project is particularly inspiring you at the moment?
I need to go back to my dissertation.
Right.
Definitely. So I'm actually writing a second book. The title might be The Love Between Huang and Lu, Women's Agency, Consumer Culture and Conservatism in 1920s China. So as I have said, the book centers on the elopement in the late 1920s. The young woman whose last name was Huang eloped with her sweetheart, her servant, from Shanghai to Suzhou. And it was a national sensation. News journalists from Shanghai and Suzhou, but not just limited to these two places. The journalists from like Hangzhou, from Beijing, and many other places all covered the case in great detail. The dramatists played the elopement on the stage. The novelists wrote a number of novels based on the elopement. There were at least three films made for the story. So there were a lot of going on because of the sensational elopement in the late 1920s and the early 1930s. So by using this case, I would like to argue that all these entertainers, filmmakers, journalists, novelists collectively denied the subjectivity of Chinese women in this period of time. They all called for the woman's return to home. So they prioritized the family value over women's independent will in this case. So by doing this, I would argue that the nationalist conservatism in the 1930s was built on a social consensus to revive or restore the traditional morals such as family value. In the book, I will piece together several different aspects of historical research. I will put together such as legal history, women's studies, media studies, and the journalist history, and something like this into one book by focusing on this case. So I think I'm in good shape of completing this book pretty soon, because I have written several chapters, and essentially because it was part of my dissertation. So that would be my second project.
Well, that sounds great too. And so good luck with that research. And thank you so much again for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.